Hello, this is Mark Grier, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 23rd issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, first article today. Trump is wasting no time in tearing down the East Wing. President Trump initially said the ballroom construction would not dismantle parts of the White House. His officials now say it is cheaper and more structurally sound to simply demolish the East Wing. As roaring machinery tore down one side of the White House, President Trump acknowledged on Wednesday that he was having the entire East Wing demolished to make way for his 90,000 square foot ballroom, a striking expansion of a project that is remaking the profile of one of the nation's most iconic buildings. Mr. Trump was unsentimental as news of the demolition spread. It was never thought of as being much, he said, of the East Wing, which was home to the First Lady's office and spaces used for ceremonial purposes. It was a very small building. The process of tearing down the East Wing was expected to be completed as soon as this weekend, two senior administrative officials said, as Mr. Trump moved rapidly to carry out a passion project that he said was necessary to host state dinners and other events. But the previously unannounced decision to demolish the East Wing was at odds with Mr. Trump's previous statements about the project and underscored his intentions to blast through the sensibilities of many in Washington to continue putting a lasting imprint on the White House. The president also said on Wednesday that the ballroom would cost $300 million, $100 million more than initially estimated. In order to do it properly, we had to take down the existing structure, Mr. Trump said. He also said, somewhat cryptically, that certain areas are being left. But the two senior administration officials who spoke on the condition of remaining anonymous confirmed that the East Wing was being demolished. The West Wing and the White House residence and the White House residence where the president lives are not affected by the project, which is the largest renovation to the White House in decades. When Mr. Trump first announced his plans for the ballroom, he pledged to the White House that the White House would not be touched by the construction. It won't interfere with the current building. It'll be near it, but not touching it, he said in July, and pays total respect to the existing building, which I'm the biggest fan of. Upon further evaluation, the White House determined it was cheaper and more structurally sound to demolish the East Wing than to build an addition, one of the administration officials had said. On Wednesday, the Secret Service kept onlookers away as heavy machinery ripped away at chunks of the building. The scope of the demolition and Mr. Trump's repeated promises that the White House itself would not be affected by the work were in many ways symbolic of how he has conducted his presidency. On a variety of issues, Mr. Trump has blown past norms and traditions, often moving so quickly that it can be too late for courts, Congress, or the public to catch up. The planned size of the ballroom would transform the footprint of the White House campus. At 90,000 square feet, the ballroom would be nearly double the size of the White House residence, which is 55,000 square feet. The ballroom is only the latest renovation plans that Mr. Trump has undertaken since he took office for the second time. He is also leaving his mark on the Oval Office, which now features many gilded flourishes. He also paved over the Rose Garden, erected huge flagpoles on the White House grounds, and is planning to build an arch in front of Arlington National Cemetery in the style of the Arc de Triomphe. Sarah Bronin, a law professor at George Washington University, who led the advisory council on historic preservation under former President Joe Biden, said that Mr. Trump's decision to tear down the East Wing appeared to run afoul of the National Historic Preservation Act, which requires federal agencies to take into account the effects of their actions on historic places. The Trump administration's short-sighted decision to start demolishing parts of the White House is exactly the kind of action the NHPA was passed to circumvent, she said. Mr. Trump has said that he is raising tens of millions of dollars in private donations to fund the project. The president plans to contribute some of his own money as well, though the amount has not been determined, one official had said. It's being paid for 100% by me and some friends of mine, Mr. Trump said. The East Wing was built in 1902 during Theodore Roosevelt's presidency as an extension to the White House, but was overhauled in the 1940s at the request of President Franklin Roosevelt. It was built primarily to conceal an underground bunker, that the Presidential Emergency Operations Center. It also added formal workspace for the White House staff, including the offices of the First Lady. Lorenzo Winslow was the architect of that addition. It has also housed the White House Social Office and served as a headquarters for planning parties, state dinners, and other events. With the demolition of the East Wing goes a slice of history. It was where President Bill Clinton met secretly with Dick Morris, a political advisor, without his staff knowing. It was where Vice President Dick Cheney was hustled to a bunker after the September 11th terrorist attack. Mr. Trump was rushed there too during protests in 2020. The White House on Tuesday did not answer questions about the bunker, but one of the administration officials said the new structure would also have enhanced security features. Amid backlash to the demolition, the White House has defended its decision, publishing photos of past renovations and construction projects undertaken by presidents. The White House says the ballroom, once finished, will have a seating capacity of 650 people, though Mr. Trump said recently it would hold 999. McCreary Architects is the lead architect. The construction team will be headed by Clark Construction, and the engineering team will be led by AECOM. Edward Lengel, the former chief historian of the White House Historical Association, said the demolition may signal that the ballroom will be far closer to the main White House than initially described. Its proximity to the original executive mansion may be much closer, practically conjoined onto it, he said. Okay, next article on the same topic. The White House wrecking ball. President Trump's demolition of the East Wing has struck a nerve in Washington and beyond. It was breezy, bright, and autumn day in Washington, the perfect backdrop for a stroll to the White House to watch the swift demolition of the East Wing. I heard it before I saw it, the thrum of construction equipment and a loud rat-tat-tat that could have been digging or drilling. As I weaved through a group of school children posing for photographs in front of the main residence, I could see the arms of two excavators bobbing around, too tall to be hidden by the thick white fence erected around the fresh construction site. Behind them, a cloud of dust obscured the clear air. It wasn't so long ago that Trump was promising his plan to build a 90,000 square foot ballroom on the grounds. Won't interfere with the current building. In fact, my colleague Luke Broadwater reported today that the entire wing, which is historically the domain of the First Lady, will be raised in the project. Images of the demolition, which began on Monday as a precursor to the construction of a $200 million ballroom, have rocketed around the globe. swiftly becoming political fodder and a perfect Rorschach test for a deeply polarizing presidency. Whatever that means. This is Trump's presidency in a single photo, wrote Senator Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts Democrat, on X, above a picture showing roof tiles and window panes cascading from the facade of the wing, having fallen victim to the excavator's jaws. Illegal, destructive, and not helping you. The project has left historians and architects deeply alarmed. The National Trust of Historic Preservation on Wednesday urged officials to pause until it could go through the legally required public review process. Last week, Trump seemed to suggest to donors that no approvals were required for the project. Trump's allies insist that the images show a president shaking up Washington, just like he promised. In a sign of awareness that they could not entirely ignore the criticism of the project, though, administration officials called the uproar manufactured outrage. In a release that detailed other renovations on the building over the years, "He's the builder in chief," the press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, said brightly on Fox News on Tuesday. In large part, he was reelected back to this people's house because he is good at building things. Leave it better than you found it? Trump, ever the developer, has certainly spent a lot of time building things at the White House. He paved over the lawn in the Rose Garden to create a patio. He has added gold filigree to the Oval Office and ornate chandeliers to the Cabinet Room, remaking the White House with an indelible imprint of Mar-a-Lago maximalism that is all but certain to outlast his presidency. "Thank you for having us at your home," John Thune, the Republican senator, majority leader, told Trump on Tuesday, even though the White House does not actually belong to him, while thanking him for everything you're doing to make this such a beautiful place. Trump is also, arguably, pretty good at tearing down things, like longstanding alliances, something the Secretary General of NATO sought to bolster on Wednesday in Washington, or the guardrails intended to hem in his impulses as he seeks revenge on his enemies. He seems to be upending all the norms that are associated with the presidency, Matt Smith, a tourist from Lexington, North Carolina, observed this afternoon after riding up to the White House on a lime scooter. Smith, an independent voter who did not back Trump, had hoped to spend his trip at Washington visiting Smithsonian art museums. With those museums closed by the government shutdown, he settled for this particular spectacle instead. "This is him physically doing it to us," Smith said, "just to show that he can." When busted norms collide. White House officials have repeatedly said that the ballroom would be paid for privately. Trump last week hosted a private dinner for donors, who may see a donation to this project as a way to curry favor with the president. But yesterday, one busted norm seemed to collide with another as Trump suggested that he might use funds from a settlement with his own government to pay for the ballroom. After my colleague Delvin Barrett reported that Trump is demanding the Justice Department pay him $230 million to compensate him for the federal investigations into him, a situation with no parallel in American history in which the officials reviewing Trump's claims are his own allies, Trump said he might use those funds to pay for his ballroom. "If I get money from our country, I'll do something nice with it, like give it to charity or give it to the White House while we restore the White House," he said. "We're doing a great job in the White House. As you know, the ballroom is under construction." The source of such compensation would typically be taxpayer dollars. The Congress is adrift. It's like we have given up, and that's not a good sign to the American public. 5 points. That's the margin in the New Jersey's governor race as polls tighten in the final stretch before Election Day. Ruth Ignalik, the Times polling editor, explains. Mike Sherrill, a Democratic candidate, now holds a slim lead in the race for governor of New Jersey, with 50% likely voters saying they plan to support her, while 45% say they support her Republican opponent, Jack Cattarella, according to the latest Fox poll taken October 10th to the 14th. That is tighter than the race just a month ago when Sherrill held a more comfortable 8% point lead. Democrats have won the last two governor's races in the state, as well as every presidential election since 1988. But Republicans are hoping to telegraph strength with an off-year victory in the race. Of concerns for Democrats, he has gained ground with independent voters and now has the edge with the group, 48% to 42%. In the latest poll, this is a reversal from a month ago when Sherrill was up slightly with independent voters. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, now on to New York City with the next article. Cuomo joins Adams at Knicks game. Is an endorsement in the cards? Former Governor Andrew Cuomo and Mayor Eric Adams looked like best of friends as they sat together at Madison Square Garden right after the debate. Former Governor Andrew Cuomo walked off the mayoral debate stage Wednesday night and headed straight to Madison Square Garden, joining Mayor Eric Adams courtside in what felt like the prelude to an endorsement. The New York Knicks were on their way to defeating the Cleveland Cavaliers in their season opener, and Mr. Cuomo, who was trailing in the polls, seemed to be hoping for a campaign buzzer beater. It was a photo op clearly meant to send a message around the city. Mr. Cuomo, who is running for mayor as an independent, still trails Zohran Mamdani, the Democratic nominee, by double digits in the polls. After Mr. Adams, who had also been running for re-election as an independent, dropped out of the race last month, Mr. Cuomo gained 9 points in one poll. He is eager to tap into the mayor's dwindling reservoirs of support among black voters and in the Orthodox Jewish community. Mr. Mamdani and the Republican nominee, Curtis Sliwa, both said during the debate that they would not accept Mr. Adams' endorsement if it was offered. Only Mr. Cuomo said he would. Mr. Mamdani posted a picture of Mr. Adams and Mr. Cuomo at the game and wrote, "Corruption goes courtside." Mr. Adams has not backed a mayoral candidate so far, but he posted a photo of himself and Mr. Cuomo at the game too, and seemed to be on the verge of offering an endorsement. "We need to win for the city," the mayor wrote. "Can't go backwards." Mr. Adams has been critical of Mr. Mamdani, calling his proposals to freeze rent on rent-stabilized apartments and to provide free buses fantasies. Before he dropped out of the race, the mayor rarely had a kind word for Mr. Cuomo, but on Wednesday evening, the two seemed like best buddies. Mr. Adams and Mr. Cuomo are bitter rivals with somewhat similar politics. Their platforms, pro-Israel, tough on crime, and skeptical of the democratic socialist ideas that Mr. Mamdani embraces, often overlap. Mr. Adams is 65, Mr. Cuomo, 67. In the early stages of the race, Mr. Adams and Mr. Cuomo looked locked in a generational fight with Mr. Mamdani, 34, a state assemblyman who has rocketed to stardom with pledges to make the city more affordable. Both have ripped into Mr. Mamdani and accused him of socialist and extremist ideas. Mr. Adams' own shot at a second term was derailed last year when he became the first sitting mayor in modern New York City history to be indicted. Federal prosecutors charged him with 5 counts of corruption, including bribery and soliciting illegal campaign donations. The charges were dropped after a recommendation from the Trump Justice Department. Mr. Adams has called Mr. Mamdani a snake oil salesman and denounced his membership in the Democratic Socialist of America and some of his politics, such as decriminalizing prostitution and supporting the closing of the Rikers Island jail complex. Last week, Mr. Adams told reporters he was having conversations about a potential endorsement of Mr. Cuomo. "Don't let anyone fool you to believe this race is over," Mr. Adams said during a recent interview on the Reset talk show. "Trust me, there's a lot of time to determine who's going to be the next mayor of the city of New York." It is unclear how much Mr. Adams' endorsement would help Mr. Cuomo. Yvette Buckner, a Democratic political strategist, said that fewer than 10% of voters remain undecided, and Mr. Adams' support was already diminished. "The window for movement is small," Ms. Buckner said, "and there's no clear indication that Adams' support would automatically migrate to Cuomo, even with an endorsement from the mayor." Before both the debate and game began, Mr. Adams appeared on the Knicks pregame show and talked up the economic benefits of having a successful professional sports franchise based in New York City. Unprompted, he joked that he was endorsing the Knicks star guard Jalen Brunson for mayor. "Just how much they give back to our city," Mr. Adams said. "They are just a great team. This is a dynasty that's being built." During his opening remarks in the debate, Mr. Cuomo mentioned the Knicks and said he hoped to get updates on the score. The Mamdani campaign aired an advertisement on ESPN during its broadcast of the game. The spot cut between footage of New Yorkers playing basketball and Mr. Mamdani on the campaign trail. Mr. Mamdani has been quick to talk up his sports allegiances on the trail, mentioning his love of soccer and appearing several times with a noted Knicks superfan, the film director Spike Lee, who endorsed him recently. Okay, more on the New York City mayoral race with the next article. New York City mayoral candidates trade zingers in final debate. The candidates sparred over their policies, personalities, and how they would deal with President Trump in the second and final debate of the mayoral campaign. Interruptions, insults, and innuendo peppered the second and final debate of the New York City mayoral race on Wednesday. In their last public exchange before Election Day, the race's 3 highest polling candidates attempted to undermine their opponents and score viral breakout moments. They often resorted to personal attacks and pushed one another to take positions on issues they had avoided addressing. Former Governor Andrew Cuomo, who is running as an independent, focused much on his criticism of the Democratic nominee and frontrunner, Assemblyman Zohran Mamdani. Mr. Mamdani often responded by arguing that many of the city's current problems could be traced to Mr. Cuomo's governorship. Curtis Sliwa, the Republican nominee, worked as an equal opportunity attacker, criticizing the other 2 candidates and frequently referring to them as my adversaries. The live studio audience at LaGuardia Community College in Queens also gave the candidates more opportunities for applause lines after they landed verbal blows against their opponents. They were frequently met with cheers or jeers or both. The exchanges grew so heated that at one point the moderators had to interrupt the candidates to remind them of the rules in an effort to curb to crosstalk. In the end, the debate ran 5 minutes over the allotted time. Here are the best zingers from the stage. Cuomo. He thinks he's a kid, and he's going to knock him on his tuchus. The moderators asked off how the candidates would respond to the highlighted presence of the federal law enforcement in the city, prompting a back and forth over how they would work with President Trump. Mr. Cuomo aimed to position himself as the best candidate to stand up to Mr. Trump. Mr. Mamdani had said, he said, would falter in the face of pressure from the White House, contending that Mr. Trump does not respect the 34-year-old assemblyman. Mamdani, we heard from Donald Trump's puppet himself. Mr. Mamdani responded to Mr. Cuomo's assertion that Mr. Trump would steamroll him by painting the former governor as a tool of the president. He has often used this line of attack in an effort to undermine Mr. Cuomo in overwhelmingly Democratic New York City, where the president is unpopular. Cuomo, not everything is a TikTok video. Mr. Mamdani's social media prowess has fueled much of his rapid political rise. And even as his opponents have sought to mimic the viral success of his snappy campaign videos, on the debate stage Wednesday night, Mr. Cuomo ridiculed them. In response to a question about the candidate's relationships to Jewish New Yorkers, the former governor tried to throw cold water on the assemblyman's comments, suggesting that his rhetoric amounted to little more than internet fodder. From Sliwa, you didn't leave. You fled from being impeached by the Democrats in the state legislature. Many of Mr. Sliwa's attacks on Mr. Cuomo focused on the sexual assault allegations against the former governor, which led to his resignation in 2021. Mr. Cuomo has denied wrongdoing and reiterated his denials several times on the debate stage. But after Mr. Cuomo referred to his having left the governor's mansion when answering a question about homeless students, Mr. Sliwa jumped in to correct the record about his departure. From Cuomo, there's one bed I'm going to save for you. The candidates' frustrations for one another surfaced again during a back and forth about the city's mentally ill homeless residents and the need for more psychiatric beds. As Mr. Cuomo laid out his plan, Mr. Sliwa interrupted to claim that the former governor had cut portions of the state's budget that could be used for mental health resources while in Albany. Mr. Cuomo responded by suggesting that if elected, he would set aside a space for Mr. Sliwa in a mental institution. From Mamdani, he spent more money on a singing water fountain at LaGuardia Airport than he did on the average cost of an affordable housing unit. The sweeping renovations of LaGuardia Airport in Queens is one of the crown jewels of Mr. Cuomo's record as governor. But during the debate, Mr. Mamdani criticized the expense of the project in light of the need to build housing for low-income New Yorkers. While responding to a question about homeless students, he mentioned the illuminated fountain, one of the flashier upgrades at the once beleaguered airport, as an example of what he saw as the former governor's misplaced policy priorities. Now, from Sliwa, you're in the back pockets, Andrew, of the developers who wined, dined, and pocket-lined you. Mr. Sliwa, who has delivered rhyming political slogans throughout the campaign, launched a new one at Cuomo, whom he has called beholden to the city's wealthy interests. He made the comment during an exchange about affordable housing initiatives, as he sought to portray himself as a better champion of working-class New Yorkers than the former governor. Another one from Sliwa. Put that crook in jail where he belongs. When the candidates were asked whether they would accept an endorsement from Mayor Adams, Mr. Sliwa emphatically said no, suggesting that Mr. Adams has committed crimes. The mayor was indicted last year on federal corruption charges, which were later abandoned by Mr. Trump's Justice Department. And then from Mamdani, we have all experienced your experience. In one of Mr. Mamdani's final attacks on Mr. Cuomo, he sought to undercut the former governor's claim that his extensive experience was his primary qualification. Mr. Mamdani argued that many New Yorkers were aware of the former governor's track record and, in fact, had been harmed by it. The assemblyman then invoked the nursing home residents who died during COVID-19 pandemic, a direct attack line he used during the first debate. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. All right, next article is from the opinion section, written by Jamil Jaffer. The secretive office approving Trump's boat strikes. Since early September, U.S. forces have carried out 8 strikes on boats in the Caribbean and Pacific, killing at least 34 people. President Trump says the strikes are legal and that the boats were trafficking drugs, but he has not offered evidence to substantiate the claim, nor has he explained how the deliberate, premeditated killing of civilians, what Colombian and Venezuelan leaders are some jurists have called murder, can possibly be reconciled with domestic and international law. The Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel has reportedly deemed the strikes lawful, but its analysis hasn't been disclosed. A quarter century after the September 11th attacks, then we find ourselves in a familiar place. Our government is once again committing grave human rights abuses on the ostensible authority of a legal opinion that is being kept secret. The Office of Legal Counsel is a division of the Justice Department that interprets the law for the executive branch. It has played this role for decades, issuing opinions that bind federal agencies on matters ranging from Social Security to Veterans Affairs to immigrants' rights. After September 11th, the office was called on by both the Bush and Obama administrations to resolve questions related to national security. It told President George Bush that the National Security Agency could listen to Americans' phone calls without warrants and that the Taliban were not entitled to the protections usually accorded prisoners of war. It assured the CIA that it could lawfully torture prisoners overseas. Later, it concluded that the Constitution's Due Process Clause was no obstacle to the government's summary execution of an American terrorism suspect. The Office of Legal Counsel's War on Terror opinions might have provoked debate and even popular fury if they had been disclosed soon after they were written, but the Justice Department relied on national security justifications to keep them from the public for years. As a result, significant errors in the office's legal analysis went unidentified and uncorrected, even as agencies relied on them to carry out policies that were deeply inconsistent with American law and democratic values. Public debate on matters of profound consequence unfolded in an information environment distorted, by official secrecy, misdirection, and selective disclosure. The office's opinions about interrogation allowed some of the most egregious post-September 11th abuses and were later discovered to include some of the most glaring legal errors. With the office's blessing, prisoners in secret CIA sites were beaten, forced into painful stress positions, deprived of sleep, and waterboarded, a method intended the office explained, to induce in the prisoner the uncontrollable psychological sensation that the subject is drowning. Military policemen and interrogators subsequently came to adopt cruel methods at Guantanamo, as well as in Afghanistan and Iraq. Some prisoners were tortured to death. One of the torture memos was leaked to the press in 2004, but it was only after other opinions by the office were made public in 2009. After years of litigation by human rights groups that the profound defects in their reasoning came fully into focus, an investigation by the Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility determined that the memo's two principal authors had committed professional misconduct. A controversial Justice Department review softened the conclusion. The Senate Intelligence Committee later concluded in a monumental report that the torture program had compromised the United States' standing in the world as well as its security. Office of Legal Counsel memos related to drone strikes were also withheld from the public, with the Obama administration warning courts that their disclosure could cause grave harm. The memo authorizing the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki, an American accused of plotting against the United States, was withheld for 4 years, even as government officials freely leaked cherry-picked information about U.S. drone strikes to the press. During that period, the CIA used armed drones to kill Mr. al-Awlaki, another American who was traveling with him, and, in a separate strike, his son, also an American. Officials said the boy was not the intended target of the strike. The administration also persuaded federal judges that it should not be required to present evidence to justify the killings, not before the killings and not after. Excuse me. That memo was published in 2014, only after the ACLU and the New York Times filed suits seeking its release, and only because the Obama administration had undermined its own national security arguments by engaging in what one judge characterized as an extensive public relations campaign to convince the public that his killing was lawful. As a lawyer for the ACLU, I was counsel in that case and the one involving the torture memos, as well as in the cases involving the lawfulness of the drone strikes that killed Americans. But by the time the al-Awlaki memo was published, it was of mostly historical interest. The practice of targeting killing had been normalized. The debate and the legitimacy of the government assassinating one of its own citizens was largely over. American courts tend to be deferential to the executive branch in cases involving national security. Both the Bush and Obama administrations repeatedly abused that deference, in an effort to control what the public learned and believed about their policies, to the detriment of our democracy. To be sure, there were good reasons to keep some of the factual information in the War on Terror opinions secret, at least for a time. But the arguments for withholding the legal analysis were far weaker, and we can see now that they were decisively outweighed by the public's interest in understanding official decisions that had sweeping implications for human rights, national security, and the United States' moral authority. The memo authorizing strikes on drug traffickers in the Caribbean and Pacific may very well be an outlandish extension of the memos the office wrote about drone strikes during the Obama administration, including the al-Awlaki memo. That memo was itself flawed. Human rights lawyers faulted it for taking an unjustifiably expansive view of Congress's 2001 authorization for use of military force. And in a 2016 book, I criticized it, myopic analysis of the due process clause. Mr. Trump's strikes are being conducted without any congressional authorization at all. A few jurists accept the notion that the United States is in an armed conflict with drug cartels. Whatever, their defects, the Obama-era memos do not supply authority for the strikes the United States is carrying out. We should not have to guess how the Justice Department concluded that these strikes on civilians were lawful. The public should be able to read the government's legal justifications for itself, and not at some point indefinite point in the future, by which time the Office of Legal Counsel's opinion's relevance will have faded. But now, when there is still something that might be done to change the government's policies and hold accountable the officials who are responsible for them. It was a mistake for the courts to allow the Bush and Obama administrations to control what the public learned about their most consequential decisions and policies in the years after September 11th. When the secrecy of the Trump administration's OLC memo comes before the courts, as it almost certainly will, it will be tragic if judges extend the same deference to an administration that has made plain its contempt for the rule of law. The courts should not debase our democracy by pretending that there are good national security justifications for keeping us in the dark. And now another article from the opinion section, this one written by Ron DeSantis and David Trone. The real lesson of the shutdown: we need term limits. A government shutdown grips Washington, leaving Americans frustrated once again with partisan squabbling. The endless stalemates and inability to find common ground are reflective of a deeper problem. The House and the Senate are dominated by career politicians, buoyed by re-election rates that routinely exceed 90%, who seem more concerned with clinging to power than serving the public. The time has come to put term limits on members of Congress. In that spirit, the two of us, one a Republican and one a Democrat, will be the co-chairs of a national campaign with the organization U.S. Term Limits, aimed at restoring accountability, competition, and common sense on Capitol Hill. The idea of imposing term limits is hardly novel. Indeed, our founders anticipated this problem. The Federalist Number 57 notes that limitation of the term of appointments is the most effective method for maintaining a proper responsibility to the people. Some observers argue that our congressional elections already serve as de facto term limits, that if voters want to send their senators and representatives home, they can just vote them out. But the reality is that incumbents today build up overwhelming advantages, making them extremely difficult to defeat. Incumbents routinely out-fundraise their challengers by nearly insurmountable margins. In the 2024 election, according to data collected by Open Secrets, PACs contributed more than $11 to congressional incumbents for every $1 they sent to challengers. There are additional advantages, like name recognition and the ability to send taxpayer-funded mailers that help those already in power. Most members of Congress are, by any reasonable definition, career politicians. And that way, Congress, too, often can be a self-serving, closed club of political insiders looking to protect their power rather than a true forum of ideas aimed at benefiting the American public. Some people see redistricting reform as a fix for what ails Washington. However, such reform would do little to curb the advantages incumbents enjoy in primaries and safe districts, nor would they dismantle the seniority system that stifles innovation in Congress. redrawing district boundaries would not erase things like name recognition and fundraising advantages that allow incumbents to cling to power. While the Constitution didn't include congressional term limits, the principle of rotation was woven into early American political culture, starting with George Washington's example of voluntarily stepping aside after two terms. No president served more than two terms until Franklin Roosevelt broke precedent with his four elections, leading to the passage of the 22nd Amendment. If term limits are good for the presidency, why not for Congress? After all, members of Congress wield enormous influence over our lives. They write our federal laws, control our tax dollars, and provide oversight of the executive branch. The concentration of power among career politicians fuels partisanship by empowering lobbyists who profit off long-standing relationships and deepens public cynicism about government. America has a ballooning national debt for which both Republicans and Democrats are to blame. If you want to know why, look no further than politicians singularly focused on spending your tax dollars in ways that bolster their chances of re-election. Greater turnover would mean more politicians invested in the interests of their constituents and the nation as a whole, over those of entrenched and influential advocacy groups. It would go a long way towards restoring trust in our political institutions and reducing the influence of money in our elections. So how do we make this happen? There are two potential paths. Congress itself could pass term limits. In 1995, a majority of House members voted in favor of a term limits constitutional amendment, though they fell short of the required two-thirds supermajority. Members of both chambers should act again and vote to limit their own power. If Congress refuses to act, states can take matters into their own hands through Article 5, Amendment Writing Convention. This mechanism seems tailor-made for this scenario. It allows states to propose an amendment when Washington will not. 12 states have already passed single-subject resolutions calling for term limits, more than a third of the way towards the 34 states necessary for that process to move forward, and nearly a quarter of the way toward the 38 states needed to ratify an amendment. Neither approach would be easy, but the threat of a convention would almost certainly compel Congress to pass an amendment, making the arduous trek down either path critical to creating a more representative government. At a time when the country feels increasingly divided, this effort at reform would bring people together. Americans are best served when their representatives bring fresh energy, new ideas, and their unique backgrounds to the table for robust debate on the challenges facing our nation. We believe reaching across the aisle and leading this effort together is the first step. But on this issue, it will ultimately be up to everyday citizens making their voices heard. We are the greatest nation on earth. We deserve a Congress that reflects that greatness. No one that serves as a retirement home for career politicians. Okay, next article. The submarines that smuggle cocaine across oceans and seas. A display of confiscated vessels at a naval base in Ecuador offers a peek into why drug smuggling is so hard to stop. The commander of Ecuador's Coast Guard gazed at the submarine that had been used to carry drugs with a defeated look in his eyes, exhausted from endless interdiction efforts that seemed to go nowhere, his sailors risking their lives while the cocaine keeps flowing. Drug smugglers, he said, were always many steps ahead. The Ecuadorian Navy has two submarines in its fleet, and the cartels? No one really knows, but definitely many more. Over the past 15 years, Ecuador, has captured about a dozen fully and semi-submersible vessels. The American authorities say they believe just a tiny fraction of such vessels have been intercepted worldwide. We were in the sprawling naval base along waterfront of Ecuador's most populous city, looking at drug trafficking ships seized by the Navy, some with the help of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. It was a graveyard of sun-baked fishing boats, semi-submersible vessels, and one hulking metal submarine. The array of vessels with a testament to was a testament of the savviness of the cartels as they come up with ways to transport drugs around the world. The U.S. military last week attacked a semi-submersible vessel in the Caribbean that it claimed was ferrying cocaine. Two people were killed, but there were two survivors, including an Ecuadorian man who was repatriated. The strike is part of the Trump administration's campaign to destroy vessels it claims are smuggling drugs. On Wednesday, it said it had struck a boat off the coast of Colombia, the first time such an attack had taken place in the Pacific. Many experts say the U.S. strikes violate international law. Rickety fishing vessels and speedboats still carry significant amounts of cocaine from South America to the United States, but semi-submersible vessels emerged in the 1990s as a way to try to evade U.S. authorities. Typically, most of the boat sits below the water surface with a fiberglass cockpit just above to allow for navigation. The boats usually have a crew of up to four, are roughly 50 feet long, and can hold 2 tons of cocaine, the Ecuadorian Navy had said. The Ecuadorian Coast Guard estimated that one semi-submersible it seized had cost about $1 million to build. A ton of cocaine, by comparison, can fetch about $25 million in the United States. By the mid-2000s, navies across South America began to see full-fledged submarines, like the hulking 30-yard-long vessel sitting at the naval base in the Guatemala's largest city. It was found in 2010. Cost about $2 million to build, and could carry up to 10 tons of cocaine, the Coast Guard had estimated. After some law enforcement forces began using thermal imaging cameras to detect vessels underwater, drug traffickers began covering them in lead and equipped them with cooling devices to help obscure their heat signatures, according to Insight Crime, a research organization. The power and range of the submarines had also grown over the years. At first, they were able to smuggle drugs only from South America to Central America. Now they can traverse the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans and reach as far as Europe, Africa, and Australia, traveling several thousand miles without refueling. Ecuador has become a major player in the global drug trade. Some 70% of the world's cocaine flows through the country. It is not a production hub, but Ecuador borders Colombia, the world's largest cocaine provider, and its busiest ports, which send bananas, fish, and shrimp to the world, provide a lucrative opportunity for cartels. Ecuador's coast and the Pacific in general is where most of the world's cocaine flows, not the Caribbean. U.S. and UN data shows. Cocaine has also fueled a surge in violence there, turning Ecuador from Latin America's safest country to one of the most dangerous. As I interviewed the Coast Guard commander, whose name the New York Times is withholding for security reasons, fireworks went off in the near distance. They do that every time a shipment reaches its destination, he said with a sigh, referring to the gang that controls the neighborhood bordering the base. A modest brick wall, topped with floppy barbed wire, was the only thing separating Ecuador's largest Navy base from the sprawling, improvisioned neighborhood, which is controlled by Los Lobos, one of the country's most powerful drug trafficking groups. The gang works closely with Mexican cartels and Albanian and Italian organized crime groups to smuggle cocaine across the world, U.S., European, and Ecuadorian officials said. Last month, Los Lobos was designated as a terrorist organization by the State Department. I asked the Coast Guard commander if he was nervous being next door to the very enemy his forces were fighting, if he ever worries that members of Los Lobos would scale the walls to attack his sailors or sabotage their equipment. Sometimes, he said, shrugging it off with a, well, what can you do, look on his face. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 23rd issue of the New York Times. Your reader today has been Mark Greyer. Thank you so much for listening.